Well, good morning to all of you. I'm so glad you're here, and I'm glad to be here too, kind of anyway. we're going to be talking about history today, and the title on your paper, your program, says Whitman Mission History, which it is slightly. Thank you, Alex. I don't know who all needs some, but if you just want to pass them back. It was suggested when they asked me to do this. I wasn't sure what they wanted, an inspirational talk or what, and they said to teach you like I would my students for a little bit of time, and then just talk about teaching history and how we do that as teachers or parents, and then have open discussion. So the best part of this is going to be the open discussion. The only problem is I have about 6 or 7 pages of notes, so I really hope we get there, which I want to. I hope that you all have thoughts and things to talk about, questions, or because that's what makes a good open discussion. And teaching history is probably my favorite thing to teach in school. So it's going to be interesting to hear your thoughts on it. All right, so to begin with this, I want a raise of hands because I like to see where all of you are. How many of you here today, you loved history when you were in school? Oh, that is devastating. What, 5 of you? 6? How many of you love teaching history today as a teacher? That's a little better. Good. Okay, so we're going to be talking about history, how it's important to our lives. An Irish poet and philosopher, James Stevens, once said, "The head does not hear anything until the heart has listened." So we're going to talk about the connection between making connection to our students' hearts and how, once we've done that, how their head will listen then. And how do we capture our students' hearts when teaching history? What makes them want to listen? What makes them want to learn about something that happened, 2,000 years ago, 3,000? How do we capture their hearts? As far back as I can remember, I've always loved stories. Sometimes it was a new book to read. Other times it was a story I was told or one I imagined in my own head. But I loved them all. I remember riding with Dad in his truck, feeling important because it was just him and me for a change. And I was in the front seat, which is a rare occurrence for a fourth born. And I remember watching mesmerized as the snowflakes flew against the windshield. And I remember begging him for a story when he was little. And I don't have any memory of the story he told that night, but I do remember that he told a story. And he told lots and lots of stories growing up. I remember feeling safe and warm from the inside right down to my wiggly toes squished into snow boots, and he told stories. He told amazing stories about our great-great-great-grandfathers, who knows how many greats back, who smuggled horses and hid them in a valley during the Civil War, which now the valley is now called Horse Valley, somewhere back east. He told about the little town where our family name comes from, sitting along the edges of the Rhine River, and he told about the great-great-great-something-grandfather who ran away from an angry stepfather and left the Catholic Church to join the Mennonites. He wove stories into the fabric of our lives. Then there were the long, dark evenings of our winter, and what I remember most about that time were the stories. After we were all ready for bed, we'd each find a cozy spot in the living room, and with the wood stove chock full of pine logs and blasting out waves of heat, my mom would read to us. And right there in the middle of that harsh winter, she took us all over the world. We smuggled gold down the mountains of Norway past Nazi soldiers. We built prairie homesteads. We hunted lions in Africa. We rode the orphan train. We tamed wild horses. We brought the gospel to cannibals. And we were the first to plant our flag on the slopes of a mountain peak. I don't remember even a fraction of all the stories she read to us, but I do remember that she read them. And then there were my grandparents, who knew more stories than anyone else I knew. And I remember my grandma lying between my sister and I in their big guest bed with extra fluffy pillows. And she'd tell us story after story until we fell asleep. I remember watching the moon shine through the lace curtains in the window and trying desperately to stay awake. But her gentle voice and the way she gently rubbed your arm usually won over pretty fast. Now my grandpa's a man of few words, so you had to really pay attention, because you didn't want to miss a story. And I used to have to do this run-walk combo trying to keep up with him. He'd be working outside, and he'd work with his cattle, and as he was fixing a fence, suddenly he'd say, "When I was a boy," and then you knew. Better pay attention. And you never wanted to miss his stories. Him and I always had a bargain. Long before I could read, I would beg him for story after story after story. And I promised if he'd read just one more, I'd read him 100 stories per story that he ever read to me once I could finally read. He still teases me about it now because my story debt to him is being the millions. Now, stories are incredibly important, and I'm sure each one of you here loves stories too as much as I did. And we're going to be talking today about how stories affect us as teachers, especially when we're teaching history. Now, Sue Monk Kidd once said, "Stories have to be told or they die. And when they die, we can't remember who we are or why we are here." And I thought that was interesting. You know, if a story doesn't get told, it's going to die. And then we don't have that connection to the past anymore. So a brief overview of this workshop today. It was suggested that I teach a history lesson to you like I teach my students. For the first bit, followed by some ideas and mechanics of how to teach history, and then end with a time of open discussion. So, one question I hope each of you can be thinking about for the end of this class is, how important is teaching history in our classrooms, especially in the younger grades? I did some research online briefly, and in most elementary schools, they no longer teach history, and most teachers feel it is obsolete, they don't need it, they don't have time for it. And honestly, I never felt like I had time for it either in my classroom. Till you get the math and the language and the reading done, which is so important, do you really have time to teach history? So is it even important at all? Now, before we get into this history lesson for today, a little bit of a reminder of the definition of history. I thought it was interesting. Of course, the root word of history would be, anybody know? Cindy? His story or story, yeah. And the very first definition for history in Webster's is a tale, T-A-L-E, story. So history is just simply a story. Now, history lesson from the Whitman Mission, what we're actually here for today. If you take a look at the map I gave you, I'm going to start off with a little bit of review. And for just a few moments here, you're going to be about 10 years old, so, and everything but your actions. A little bit of review to start off today. Take a look at your map and take a look at the Oregon Trail. So this is simply the review for the beginning of a lesson. And I like to start off with all my lessons just with review, just to kind of pull everybody in again and make sure we are all on the same page. And review, take a look at where the Whitman Mission is. And I'll be honest with you, I had a lot of trouble with this name. I looked it up online. I had friends look it up online for me. And we never did quite figure out how to say it because there's, seems like, numerous ways to say it. So the best way I could come up with to say it is Wailapu. So if any of you have a better, more correct pronunciation, I'd be happy to hear. But if you were my students, I'd probably have you circle that with a red crayon. Somewhere along the way, we would have placed that mission as we came along the Oregon Trail. Now, the next thing is the timeline, and I don't know, how many of you have a timeline in your classroom? Great. If you don't have a timeline, I would say definitely get a timeline. Even if you have to make it yourself, timelines are just great. Narcissa Whitman's birth, 1808, so we're looking at, my timeline's kind of falling down here, but so we're looking at this timeline is in increments of 100 years. Century. So we're looking at right here, 1808, westward expansion, right after there. So Narcissa Whitman was born, and this would all be review dates for a test. Then the missionary party that started for Oregon Territory was 1836. So we're moving down a little bit here. Not quite halfway. Now the new date for today, and if you have a pen or a pencil on the back of your paper, write down the date. November 29, 1847. All right, November 29, 1847. That is the new date that you need to get into your heads. And now we are almost halfway between, right about here. Now, this is the date of the massacre, and that's what we're going to be reading about today, because I thought that was kind of the most interesting part of the Whitman mission. It was just interesting. So, I'm going to be reading a story to you, and I'm going to start back a little bit of where we ended yesterday or the day before. And while I'm reading the story to you, I want you to be drawing a picture of what's happening, okay? You're going to need to know this stuff for your test. You're going to need to be able to write a paragraph about this massacre on your test, okay? You don't need to make them too gory or bloody or anything, but just draw a brief picture of this, of what's happening, and I'll inform you of any details that you especially need to note, okay? So you have the date already, and I'm going to start reading to you, and I'm going to start back a little bit from where we ended yesterday. Now, can you all see well enough if I turn the light off? Not too dark in here. My students, I started it years ago, and whenever I'd read a story to them, we'd turn the light off and light a candle, and they could hardly have me read to them unless the light was off. Kind of relax them. And if it's a scary story, it feels a little bit colder and it's more real. Okay, so the poor Indians are amazed at the overwhelming numbers of Americans coming into their country. Narcissa wrote to her folks, August 23, 1847, they seem not to know what to make of it. For their part, the poor Indians seem to have made up their minds about Dr. Whitman and his proud wife, who looked down her nose at them and wouldn't let them in her nice house on their land. So that's what we read the day before, and I'm going to read today the new part. It's called Measles and Blood. It was a cold, gray November of the people at the mission. 70 or so, including immigrant families and the Whitman's extended family, many were sick. Sick, too, were the Indians in their lodges not so far away. With Marcus's relentless doctoring, or in spite of it, the white folks slowly got well. Their immune systems knew how to fight measles. It was different for the men, women, and children of the Cayuse and other tribes. It didn't seem to matter what help they got from their medicine man or Dr. Whitman, they still died. Young Catherine Sager reported seeing as many as 6 Cayuse buried every day, and that's not all she saw and heard, not nearly all. She heard Marcus tell what the Indians were saying, that he was poisoning them so that he could give their country to his people. She watched from her own sick bed as weary Marcus sat up through the night of November 28, 1847, keeping watch over the sick folks. So make sure you make that connection between the measles and how the Indians are feeling. The next day was foggy. Some menfolk at the mission were working cattle in the dreary outdoors. It was butchering season. Narcissa was as gloomy as the weather that morning. Suddenly, her mood turned to terror at the sight of angry men in her kitchen, their fierce faces painted black and white. She shouted for Marcus, and in the next instant, he and the Indians were on one side of the bolted kitchen door, with everyone else on the other. Catherine Sager remembered an explosion that seemed to shake the house. A rifle shot, angry voices. "Oh, the Indians!" Narcissus screamed. "The Indians!" as the warriors ran outside. A shot to the neck, tomahawk blows and slashes to his head and face had not killed him at first. But there was no way to save blood-drenched Marcus Whitman. In the next moment, Narcissa appeared at an upstairs window where a bullet struck her. Like her husband, she did not die immediately. She was still alive when the Indians ordered one of the men, Andrew Rogers, to help carry her out of the mission house. Once outside, both he and Narcissa were shot dead. It is said that one of the killers lifted her head by its red gold hair and hit her face, the face that had always seemed to the Indians so prideful and aloof whenever its owner looked their way. 14 people died before the fury of killing was over. You need to note that 14 people, including Catherine's big brother, 17-year-old John, and 15-year-old Frank. A black-robed Catholic priest came to the devastated mission by the Walla Walla and helped the survivors lay the victims to rest. All right, so now the ending of the story. And this is a question we're going to think about at the end of this class. Were Marcus and Narcissa Christian martyrs, or were they and the Indians victims of misunderstandings and unintended consequences? Probably a little of this and a little of that. In the end, Mrs. Whitman wanted to be a homemaker, and the young Mrs. Whitman, before she was married, had wanted to stand out, to do something extraordinary. While one might have advised the other to be careful what she prayed for, each had her prayers answered in ways that she did not expect at the end of the Oregon Trail. Now that question, were they simply victims of misunderstandings or were they actually Christian martyrs, we're going to talk about. So, once we are done with this lesson, in your spare time, I want you to write one journal entry written by Catherine Sager about her experience of watching this massacre unfold. All right, get those details in your head. Now, who can tell me? Oh, let me see if I can see all your name tags. Carrie, what do you think? Were they martyrs, Christian martyrs, Marcus and Narcissa? Or were they victims of misunderstandings of the whole culture and everything? What do you think?
I would
say they were victims, but I'm not sure. All right. Anybody here think different? What do you think, Sandra?
I'd go with the victims.
Victims?
They would have been, like, if the Indians would have been welcome to their house and if they would have shown them, I don't think it would have happened. They would
right.
have had the communication there, so yeah, it's either victims or misunderstandings.
Very true. There's different ways to look at it, and I'd actually never done a lot of research into this Whitman mission, but the more I did, the more I realized how why it probably happened, maybe, parts of it anyway. So if this was a regular class, we'd probably do some sort of group discussion where everyone exchanged face-to-face, what do you think, what's your opinion, were they victims, were they martyrs, why do you think that? Get your students talking about it. And what is one thing you think the Whitmans could have done differently to make the story have a different ending? Christina, what do you think? Right. So there's lots. We just barely touched on the story, and there's so much before this that would have led up to this story. But a lot went into that. The story, the way it could affect our lives is how we relate to other cultures. And you could explain that to your students. Like, you go, we're comfortable in our own culture. Narcissa went there to convert these Indians, and she ended up dying. And they all thought she was a proud, or many of them thought she was a proud woman. She did not breach their culture at all, and she did not gain their trust. And there's lots of different things she did. She didn't allow them in her house. And when they did come in, she resented that because they were dirty. She called them dirty savages and on and on. At the same time, she did want to see them converted. She was not just this bad woman either. She did want, that was her goal, she wanted to see them converted, but she was not willing to get out of her comfort zone to bridge the culture, which ended up creating a lot of barriers and chasms there in their relationship. Now, to end this class, I'm just going to read one quote to you from an Indian. Now, this was the beginning of a desperate, savage scramble for land, the Cayuse War, that turned very, very ugly. And finally, five Indian men surrendered themselves because their nation, their Indian tribes were just getting decimated. So they finally surrendered themselves. And one of them said, and you think about what he said, at his hanging, his name was Telokiai, something like that. And he said, before he was hanged, he said, "Did not your missionaries tell us that Christ died to save his people? So die we to save our people." So that's a direct quote from one of the Indian men who surrendered his life so that the killing of his tribe could end. And Marcus and Narcissa had gone there to bring the gospel to them. So there's a lot more we could get into there. And we're going to end with that for now. And back to being grown-ups again. Now, a little bit about teaching history. Probably the first thing I think about when I think about teaching history is you have to be passionate about it. It's contagious. If you love teaching it, your students are going to probably love learning it, and it's not going to be a hardship for them to love it. And another thing is to be knowledgeable. It's very hard to be passionate about something that you have no clue what you're talking about, that it's just all kind of out there somewhere. So that comes to the next one about reading. And how many of you love to read? Love to read. That's great. The more you read, the more interesting of a teacher you will be, I guarantee it. And read widely. Biographies, just a wide range of authors and books and subjects. Just be interesting. Your students want you to be interesting. Another one is to listen to other people's stories. That's probably your biggest resource, is other people. And last summer, I knew I was going to be teaching about the Holocaust the next year. And so I'd kind of been rolling that idea over my head. And I met our neighbor lady, and we got to talking about just random stuff. I don't know how we ended up on the subject. And she told me how in Germany, she's from Germany, and years and years ago, she couldn't remember all the details, but her great-grandmother hid Jews in her house during the Holocaust. And of course, that just grabbed my attention. I said, well, what more do you know about it? And she said she was going to try to find out something about a trap door in their dining room. It sounded really interesting and dramatic. But keep your eyes tuned to other people's stories, because they will have them. Everyone has something that you might need when you teach in your class. Tell your students. Another thing is to quote your specific person of study in history. Don't just tell them this is the kind of person they were. Show them by quotes or direct references to that person. If you're studying the Holocaust, don't tell your students, Anne Frank remained a positive person, blah, blah, blah. Read her journal to them. How much more powerful would a direct quote be? She wrote this, I don't think of all the misery, but of the beauty that still remains. Doesn't that show her strength of character? And here's another one. I see the world being slowly transformed into a wilderness. I hear the approaching thunder that one day will destroy us too. I feel the sufferings of millions. And yet, when I look up at the sky, I somehow feel that everything will change for the better and that this cruelty too shall end, that peace and tranquility will return once more. And so that, you don't even have to tell your students that she was a positive person, courageous. It shows in her journal entry. Another thing about history is to make it real, make it come alive. And I found out when I started teaching history, a lot of my students weren't too enthused about it. It was, you know, just stuff that happened way back. And then I started a different curriculum, which really, really changed the way I taught history and really changed history in my classroom. And it made it come alive. And I'll be happy to talk to you more about that curriculum. Probably the biggest thing I loved to do when I was teaching history, or teaching anything, but for sure history, is to use props. And that can be embarrassing. One time, I was embarrassingly unprepared for teaching class, one of those days where I hadn't gotten ready in time. And right before class started, genius struck, and I was like, I just have to get dressed up for this. And so we were studying Cleopatra. So I ran down to the kitchen, rummaged around, and came back down the hall swathed in this tablecloth from the kitchen. And I was trying to sneak back in before anyone could see me. And of course, I met a co-teacher, and just the look on their face. And right then, I tripped, came kind of tripping down the hallway in this tablecloth. And the look on his face, like, I always knew she was crazy, and I know for sure now. I tried to pretend I was all normal, but it was hard to be sophisticated when I was tripping up like that. Now, if you're going to make history come alive to your students, make sure you're okay with looking a little bit foolish sometimes. Just try to keep your dignity, I guess. I didn't feel very dignified at the moment. Another one is act out the story. One year, I was teaching third grade, I think it was, and we were in the middle of learning the Spartan and the Greek culture, all that stuff. And for noon recess one day, we acted out the Battle of Marathon, minus the warfare. And one group under the tree were the Spartans, another group the advancing Persian army, the third group was the Greek army, and each student got a turn to be Pheidippides, the legend, the runner who legend tells us died after he delivered the news of victory. And of course they all had great fun running as hard as they could and dying a dramatic death at the end. They never forgot that story, and they never forgot where the name Marathon comes from. So act it out. One note of caution, I guess, be sensitive to the community you're in. It can it can spiral quickly out of control. I found out this last year, I was teaching the Civil War, and suddenly I had fourth grade boys against fifth grade boys. One side was the Union, one side was Confederate, and they were going to war. So that was not exactly what we had in mind. So just, especially that age group, they love to act things out. It can get a little bit overdone, but act it out within reason. It'll make it stick like nothing else will. Until we acted at the Battle of the Marathon, it was just, you know, the beach and they're fighting on the beach. It wasn't real until we actually did it, and then they knew. And on their tests, they could write detailed paragraphs about what happened, I think in part because they'd acted it out. Another one is to feed your students. So, this is kind of off the subject, but whether it's a cultural food of whatever you're studying, if it's in geography or whatever, feed them. It can be hardtack. If you're studying pioneers, it can be just anything. I'd often give my students a piece of chocolate before we studied something. I tried not to do it too often. And I told them I gave it to them simply because I wanted them to know that studying a lesson is sweet and the reward of it is beautiful. And so they could sit there and eat their chocolate and think about adjectives and adverbs that they were dreading and yet enjoy the chocolate and get through any hard lesson, and it made it stick. As much as you can, teach with using extra things. Make teaching dimensional and make it stick. Another one is to encourage student thought and participation. One thing that proved powerful for some of my students was keeping a journal entries, some more than others, especially the girls seem to do better in this. We were studying the subject of slavery in North America this past year, and the whole class and several students in particular were extremely worked up about the inhumane treatment. We were reading the book Underground to Canada. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that, but it really shows the inhumane treatment by some of the slave owners. And this one little girl in particular, after we'd read one section, she was sitting in her desk and she's kind of shaking a little bit, and she said, "I'm just so mad at those slave owners. And I said, "Just get your journal out, write about in there what this story makes you feel, how you wish it could have been different, what you would have done if you'd been there." And we did that different times. And it kind of helped them process it in their minds, because some subjects in history are really big and they're really ugly and hard to explain to children. And if they can work through that, because you don't want to expose them to too much, but you don't want to hide history from them either. They need to know what happened. And so it kind of helped them to work through that. And use a student's emotions about a story to apply it to their own lives, events in their own lives. They have to make that connection between history and what they're living today. And so a trick of memorization of anything is to simply attach an emotion to an event, and you will not forget that, at least not very easily. So attach an emotion to something you're teaching, and they will most likely remember that. While studying the history of the Dutch Mennonites, we read a lot of stories from the Martyr's Mirror, and sometimes I was almost afraid it was too graphic. We focused in particular on the story of Dirk Williams exchanging his freedom to help his captor, you know, that famous picture. And non-resistance became just a hot topic in our classroom. So one day I gave them the hypothetical scenario of what would they do if someone came into their home or into the school and wanted to hurt one of the younger children. Not them in particular, maybe them, but someone younger than them, someone that they would like to protect and keep from getting hurt. And I told them to discuss it with the parents over the weekend and come home, or come back to school on Monday. We'd have a group discussion about what would be the right way to relate to that. So they did that, and Monday afternoon we arranged an onion group discussion where the center circle rotates every 60 seconds and everybody gets a chance to talk to everybody else. And they had this discussion and they thought they were, you know, grown-ups having this deep discussion, and their insight was amazing. You know, one little boy thought maybe you could kind of kick him in the leg and, you know, kind of distract him, and the other little boy that I thought would be very violent said, "Oh no, you don't do a thing, that's bad. The Bible says nothing, don't even kick him." So So it got very interesting, and they loved it, and they felt like they had solved a big problem when they were done. And their insight was just humbling, because as an adult we think, yeah, we might have things figured out, and then to hear little children discussing some big issue like that, and actually wrapping their minds around what would be okay to do and what would be okay not okay to do, is amazing, because they know it's in their hearts. They know, they knew it wasn't going to be okay to actually kick them, even though they all wanted to. It was all okay until we brought up the subject of how they were going to go home from school and their sibling was going to take the last cookie or mess up their game. How was non-resistance going to play out then? As much as you can, bring it home to events in their own lives. Another thing is to include geography and timeline, which many of us in the younger grades probably teach almost more geography than history. And what I love about the history I've been teaching is that it incorporates geography right into the history, so you're teaching it all at once. And when you learn about a culture, you're learning about that country, and you learn about the placement in the world. It's so important for students to know when and where a story took place. I like to tell my students that nothing makes you look more uneducated than not knowing where a country is in the world. You need to know where things are. And if you don't know, look it up, figure it out. Another thing is to sing songs and do chants. I thought of bringing some of my students here today to sing some songs. I have a CD it's called Geography Songs, and it has a song for absolutely every country in the world. And so my dream was always to teach all my students all those songs, so they know every country. There's something about singing or chanting or doing a motion that rivets it in their minds, because you kind of, all the different learning styles come together when you do that. You're hearing, you're seeing, you're doing, and you're feeling, you're moving. And so we did a lot of that. We sang a lot of songs. And the CD I have, I would just learn them myself first, and then I'd sing them to my students until they got them. And then it took very, very short, and they were bellowing them out the top of their lungs. So. And chants. What I mean by chants, I guess, is also in the history that I've been teaching, for each section, not quite every section, just about, is there's a chant that goes along with it. So you're learning about Dirk Williams helping his captor. Well, you do the motion of him reaching up to help him up, his captor out of the ice. You know, just as much as you can, incorporate action into it. I guess I just always have to be moving, and so that helps. That makes me want to let my students move when they're learning it. It just helps rivet it. And as far as the timeline, I just don't think, I did not realize how important a timeline was until I had one. And I wish I'd known that from the first year I taught. I remember the shock one day when I realized that some of my second graders, and maybe that's just normal, but they didn't have any concept of the 6,000-year-old Earth or that kind of thing. And it kind of shocked me, and I thought, well, you know, they are only in second grade. And I thought, but they need to know that. That's a core belief of ours. And so a timeline helps to root that. I like to tell my students that, you know, way back there, 6,000 years ago, where God is, you know, God opened his mouth, and he started to tell a story. And he's still telling the story, and we're all players in his story. And a timeline just helps to show our place in history, in the world, and it shows all of us how insignificant we actually are. You know, we're just, you know, right around here somewhere, and yet, then if you start counting back, it's not really. It actually also shows how, in a sense, young the Earth is. Only 6,000 years, you know, the age of the pyramids and Abraham's after, you know, it just helps to get it in their heads. One year, we're studying the Roman Empire, and we just finished the story of Octavian Augustus, and they really enjoyed all the drama surrounding that story. And I had my students open their Bibles to Luke 2, and together, out loud, we read those familiar words. Everyone knows them, and it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And we read those, and it was just quiet, and Olson, one of the little boys whispered, and his eyes were just round, and he said, "You mean the people that we learn about in history and the people in the Bible are the same thing?" I said, "Absolutely." And it was just amazing, because you just could watch that on their face as it just unfurled, and it's like, it's the same thing. Another thing is to use forced attention to detail. As you tell or you read a story, have your students draw out what's happening somehow. I'm a big fan of that. I'd sometimes even have them draw some out a devotional. It forces someone to pay attention. And they don't even know that you're forcing them to pay attention. And every once in a while, especially if there's certain facts you want them to really remember, and we had a very abbreviated history lesson, but in a normal history lesson, there would have been certain facts I would have said, okay, now remember, you know, you put this in your drawing, whether it's something, a date, or somehow you add that. And what the student doesn't realize is that they're taking notes. And especially in the younger grades, taking notes is daunting. For many, it would be hardly possible to take proper notes to remember stuff by. So doing it this way, they're taking notes of sorts, and they don't even know they're doing it. And then I had a binder for each student, and they kept those papers. And then when it's time to study for the test, they could go back to those drawings, and they could kind of relive that story. And they had the facts that they needed to know for the test. All right, another one is to portray historic figures accurately. And this one was kind of hard for me sometimes, but avoid the temptation to pose individuals as either good or bad people. Because the truth is that many times in history, bad men did good acts occasionally, and good men did bad. So don't just say, okay, here's a good man, here's a bad man. Your students know. They're going to already know if a good man did something bad. And so don't just paint everybody with the same paintbrush and draw a line right down the middle. Give your students a true story and let them draw their own conclusions to it. Albert Einstein said, education is not the learning of facts, but the training of the mind to think. So knowing the date of the massacre at the Whitman Mission is not going to affect their lives in the least. It's not probably going to aid them in any way. But if they can think through the whole cultural misunderstandings and the way the Whitmans maybe could have reached out better to the Indians, or the way the Indians could have, you know, overcome some of that barrier, they can think through that. That's what's going to help them in life. And so we can look at the Whitmans and say they made mistakes, and they did. They were good people. They made mistakes. They had the best interests in mind. But let them think through it. We were studying the Bolshevik Revolution last year, and we were reading the book Days of Terror. How many here of you have read the book Days of Terror? It's a good book to read to your students, at least if you're teaching a little bit older grades. I distinctly remember biting my tongue many times because I wanted my students to make the connection between the story and our lives. But I wanted them to do it on their own, so I just kept biting my tongue. I thought, surely someone will. And one day as I read the description of the Mennonites' wealthy farms and their beautiful homes and abundant food, one of the boys who's sitting right up here in the front, and the light was off and everyone was just listening, and he just blurted out, shocking us all, and he said, "That's us! That's us. We are those people." And I think I actually got goosebumps. And I was so excited. He'd finally taken a story from history and connected it to today. And the whole class just sat there, and they're like, "Yeah, that's who we are. We are those Mennonites. We have everything. We have jobs. We have beautiful homes. We have food. You know, we are the ones who have everything, just like those Mennonites did in that story." And ever after that, they really made the connection through the whole thing. And then we could talk from there on. It was a basis to talk about what we can do with our affluence and our wealth so that the same thing doesn't happen again. And so after they make the connection, you can kind of bring it around and use it to build off of that. Cicero, 63 BC is when he lived. He was a Roman, worked for the Roman consul, and he said this: "To remain ignorant of history is to remain forever a child." And there are parts of history that are messy and ugly, and we don't like to remember, and we don't really even like to teach. One thing we cannot do is hide those parts from our students. They need to know the truth of what happened. Of course, age appropriateness and all, but they need to know, because they're going to find out someday. And if you glossed over all that now, they're going to look back and say, "Well, what was the deal? That actually happened in history, and I sure didn't get taught that." So they need to know the truth of what happened. Reel your students in with random facts about a person in history. We studied Peter the Great last year, and the class found it absolutely fascinating that he had a special student, or special servant, whose stomach he used for a pillow whenever he wanted a nap. He was a very busy man, just always running around doing things, so if he needed a nap in the afternoon, he would just have his servant lay down, he'd lay his head on his stomach, and he had a nice pillow. And it was just a random fact that's not going to affect their lives at all. And one young man found it so fascinating, he went home and did an in-depth report about Peter the Great. So you can use those funny, random little facts and pull your students in. One thing I found out recently I never knew before, former President Calvin Coolidge enjoyed buzzing for his bodyguards, and then he would hide under his desk while they searched for him. And I thought that was terribly interesting. Like, it makes me want to read more about him. I basically know nothing about him, but surely a man that did that would be interesting to read about. So pull your students in with just any random fact you find. It doesn't have to be educational, but keep your students off balance with what you throw at them. That make them want to dig deeper on their own, because when they do it on their own, that's when you know that you've successfully taught something. The last part, I'm going to hurry up here so we get to our open discussion. Tell stories. And I cannot stress this one enough. And remember that quote I told you by Sue Monkhead, stories have to be told or they die. And when they die, we can't remember who we are or why we're here. Stories have to be told. For long as the world has been, humans have been telling stories. And storytelling is considered one of the oldest forms of education. And the storing method of teaching, and we don't have time to get into all that, is one of the most powerful ways of teaching. Jesus used it. He told stories. People relate and are willing to listen so much better when it comes through a story. All through the New Testament, we see Jesus using stories to teach. And I don't think there's a better teacher we can copy. And as a teacher myself, I am of the firm belief that it's basically impossible to tell your students too many stories, unless you're not getting your work done. But just tell stories, oodles of them. You can, anytime, sometimes I tell my students, I think of a story and I wanted to tell it to them so badly. So I'd say, okay, I thought of a story, and they would just, and I'd say, get your math done. And then we'll, you know, tell the story. Because I had to discipline myself, it was hard. I wanted to tell it to them right then, but I had to wait. You might think I'm not a very good storyteller, or I don't know how, but teach yourself how. Telling stories is important enough. You need to expend energy in learning how to do it well. And even if you're not a natural-born storyteller, that's not what's so important. The important thing for your children or for your students is that you tell the stories. They don't care so much if you do it perfectly or everything's just right, but tell the stories. And oftentimes when you tell a story, there's no need to explain the moral at the end. You don't need to say, okay, so this is what, you know, this is what they did wrong, this is what they should. Your students are going to be smart enough to figure that out themselves. The students and your children, they know. And if they don't know, you can help explain it. But they will be able to figure it out, and it has much more impact on them if they figure it out themselves than if you spoon feed it to them. History makes us aware of others around us, and it makes us aware of our small part in this world. Another thing, children need to hear and read a lot of biographies and true stories, and there might be some controversy on this point. I'm just going to say it. I like to think that children also need some C.S. Lewis and Dr. Seuss and that kind of stuff, okay? They need a balance, all right? They need to hear Bad Dog Marley and Amelia Bedelia as much, maybe not quite as much, but basically as much as they need those true stories and biographies. C.S. Lewis once said, "Since it is so likely that children will meet cruel enemies, let them at least have heard of brave knights and heroic courage." And I think that's so true. They're going to meet cruel enemies in this world. They need to know about bravery and courage. And also, again, remember what James Stevens said, "The head does not hear anything until the heart has listened." And this is my last point here, but capture your students with your story. They want to know your story, and that's probably the surest way of getting their attention, is to tell them your story. My students love to hear the story, but the day I was in first grade, and I ended up with a pink elephant that sported gray inner ears because I didn't follow directions. And they thought that they loved stories, especially your students will love stories that kind of show you up. they really enjoy those. So tell them your story, because your story is important to their lives. Now, James Stevens also said, "The heart knows today what the head will understand tomorrow." And just back to that young man who made the connection between the Dutch Mennonites and their affluence into our lives today, his heart made the connection. He doesn't really understand the full weight of what he said that day or thought he understood. But when he's an adult looking back, he's going to understand it in a fuller way. But the heart knows. Your children will make the connection. They really will. All right, let's take a little bit of time here for some open discussion. I want to hear what your ideas for teaching history are, how you teach history in your classroom. And also, I want to know if you think it's important to teach history. Let me see. Alex, what can you tell us about teaching history?
Well, I did the Living Prince this last year, too. And I figured out, too, that the chanting and hand motions was a lot. If I can remember, I taught them different motions for all the oceans and the seven continents. And, yeah, I think that'd be my biggest thing, is to do hand motions and repetition.
That's great. That's so true. That repetition thing and the movement with the words. I started doing that with Bible memory and just making up a motion for about every phrase that we were memorizing, and it helped to make the Bible memory go smoothly. They memorize it faster that way. Not every child needs that, but there are a few that do. Any other ideas you have as far as history? What are some tips that you do in your classroom? It is, yeah.
We quickly tried to catch her up, and she did very well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a scary when you suddenly get a student that doesn't know where they are. It's not their problem. It's really important, I feel. What do you as teachers do about your time? I know probably most of you teach in multi-grade. I always ran into the time thing, because history really, at the end of the day, is not as important as math and reading language. But I feel it's very important. But how do you fit that in? Especially if you're trying to do drill and all that kind of stuff. Good. Yeah, having an empty class period like that would be great. Yes?
You can throw in, when I taught, we'd throw history story in, like, the morning devotions.
Mm-hmm.
Things that,
Right.
Points that matched up with what they were studying.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting story.
Kind of incorporate it throughout the day, yes. Yeah, it's a challenge to kind of always try to decide, you want to get those books done and you want to be thorough, but you want them to actually learn something too and actually enjoy doing it. It's kind of like walking a tightrope, but kind of get it all in there together. The curriculum that I've been teaching, how many of you are familiar with the Living Threads? So, some of you are. I promise you I'm not getting a commission off of this or anything. But I became familiar with it one year when I was back east, and I saw, and I just come through teaching a curriculum that of geography that I found really difficult and very hard to make interesting. Like, it kind of taxed my brain cells and my students. And I saw, and I just knew, I was like, I have to teach that history. And my school board has been very, very gracious to me. And so they said, sure, why don't you try it? So what it is not workbooks as such. What you're doing is telling stories to your children. You're reading them stories. Basically, that's what the bulk of their work. They almost have no written work through the unit. And then they get this 4 or 5 page test. And in general, if you've taught it well, your students will ace it every time because of the stories. And I think that's the only thing connection I can make to it. And it has just a lot of interesting facts. And if you want to know more about it, you can look it up online or, yeah, talk to Miss Alex or me or, you know, some of you have taught it or know about it. It's really, really good history. So if your school's looking for a new history, make sure you mention that to your school board. One thing I will say, it requires a lot of teacher work. You can't just, you know, go to school at 8 o'clock and quickly look at your book. You have to be prepared and you have to have read ahead and thought it through. Otherwise, you will be the one tripping down the hallway in a tablecloth. Now, in closing, unless does anyone have more ideas or thoughts on teaching history, I hope all of you are going to go back to your schools and teach history like maniacs, because your students need to know. Remember this, N.D. Wilson said this, your life is a story. You will struggle, and you will mourn, and you will end. Dust you are, and to dust you will return. Your days are numbered, in the rain or in the sun, in the snow, or as the yellow leaves fall. There is a day waiting for you that will be your last. You will return to the dust, your birth scene will find its counterpoint. From this moment on, until then, you will live a story. And I'll add, you will live your story. And it's important. Now, history matters to me very much because stories matter and people's stories matter. Now, do your students and yourself a favor and teach history this year. And tell them stories. Tell them so many stories that they can't even remember them all. Because I promise you, even if they don't remember, those stories are in their hearts and they're inside. And I think back to all those stories I was told as a child and read to in the hours my mom read to us. And I just think it's all in there. And she didn't realize, she just did it because, well, she loved it, I guess, and we loved it probably more than she did even. But it matters to children that you tell them stories and that you read them stories. And my life will forever be so much richer because of so many individuals in it that believed in telling me stories and believed in that teaching history was important. And one more thing, just inspiration before you leave. Probably my favorite quote currently. It's kind of a little bit longer one, so I'll hurry up here. Andy Wilson also said this, and I think about this, I'm not going back into the classroom this year for the first time in 5 years, and it's I often wish I was, but I'm headed off to do some other things. And teaching, I know the feeling of being at, say, an institute or getting ready for school and all the books are brand new and everything and smells good. And then, you know, comes the crunch time of, you know, you got to bed late the night before, you're not ready, you can't find the right art project, and, you know, you have some sort of discipline problems in your classroom, and it can get really discouraging, and you can wonder what you're doing, why is it worth it, why am I here? And here's something I read to myself over and over this last school year, and I thought about the reason you're in the classroom, and the reason you do anything is because you're doing it for Jesus Christ, and you're doing it to bring him glory, and you're doing it because of what he did for you. And if you do this for your students, you will have a very successful year. And this is what he says. Lay your life down. Your heartbeats cannot be hoarded. Your reservoir of breath is draining away. You have hands. Blister them while you can. You have bones. Make them strain. They can carry nothing in the grave. You have lungs. Let them spill with laughter. I can be giving my fingers, my back, my mind, my words, my breaths, or I can grasp after the vapor and the vanity for myself, dragging my feet, afraid to die, and therefore afraid to live. And like Adam, I will still die in the end. Living well is the same thing as dying for others. So when you go into your classroom and you live well and you teach well, you're going to do that by dying to yourself and to your own desires and living for your students and living for Jesus Christ. And I have full confidence that you're going to do a great job this year, especially if you teach history.